Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of child sexual abuse and the murder of two girls.
So there have been a couple of updates in the various cases around the Delphi murders that we cover, and we thought we'd hop on here really quick and talk about some of those updates and share with you what we know. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews. We're The Murder Sheet, and this is
The Delphi Murders, recent court filings in the cases of Richard Allen and Kagan Klein.
If the word confidential appears in a court filing, everybody is intrigued. Understandably, it's an interesting word. It conjures some interesting possibilities. Although I think some of the things we'll be talking about in this episode indicates that it's not always quite as interesting as we hope.
And also, I think it's important to note that these cases, the Kagan Klein case and the Richard Allen case, take place in different counties with different prosecutors and different judges. And for whatever reason, in Miami County, Prosecutor Jeff Sinkovics, Judge Tim Sparr, they do things very differently than what happens in Carroll County with Prosecutor Nick McClelland. In fact, I think it would be fair to say most counties do things differently than Nick McClelland does. In the Kagan Klein case, this means they tend to be very open and above board about everything that happens in that case.
Yes. So when we were getting texts today from other friends who follow this case, noting that something confidential was going on in the Kate and Klein case, we were already intrigued because we were like, things have been a little bit more transparent in Miami County. So we really wanted to look into what could be going on.
And if you go to the My Case page for Kagan Klein, there's references to exclusion of confidential information. People were wondering, does this mean that Kagan Klein is giving out confidential information about the Delphi murders or about the child sexual abuse materials cases or what have you? And the answer is no. What was filed today in the Kagan Klein case was Kagan Klein's pre-sentence investigation report. Those reports are generally prepared as a matter of course before someone is sentenced, and they contain the sort of information you or anybody else would want to know before imposing a sentence on someone. Basically, what kind of person is this? What is he like? What were the crimes he did? Is he connected to family? Is he remorseful? What kind of jobs he's had? Gets into a lot of very, very personal things.
Is it fair to say that this is all with the intent to help Judge Spahr make a decision, an informed decision, when it comes time to essentially sentence Kagan?
Yes. And it also could be useful if Kagan's sentence includes a period of time on probation. It would be useful for his probation officer to have this kind of information. All that being said, this pre-sentence report is not available to us. It is being kept confidential.
Is that unusual?
No. In fact, again, unlike what we've seen in Carroll County, the probation officer who helped prepare this report, basically, he filed something at the same time he filed the report indicating that it needed to be kept confidential pursuant to Indiana Code Section 3538.113. And you hop over to that particular section of the code, and it says, and I will read this, Section 3538.113, Confidentiality of Pre-Sentence Report or Memoranda. A. Any pre-sentence report or memoranda and report of physical or mental examination submitted to the court in connection with sentencing shall be kept confidential. B. The material specified may not be made available to any person or public or private agency other than 1. The convicted person and his counsel, 2. The prosecuting attorney, 3. A probation department, 4. The community corrections program in which an offender is placed, 5. The Indiana Criminal Justice Institute established under IC 526, except where specifically required or permitted by statute or upon specific authorization by the court and the convicted person. So what we're seeing there is keeping this particular type of report confidential is well within the normal bounds of procedure. This is how it works. You may have the attitude that people should know all this private information about people who are convicted of a crime. But the fact is, this is what the law says.
This is normal.
This is normal. This is ordinary routine procedure. This is not someone like Jeff Sinkovics, the prosecutor of Miami County. This isn't him making a decision unilaterally to keep something secret.
This is them following the prescribed rules under Indiana law.
Yes, this is how the system works. So there's nothing unusual to see here.
You love that. I think this highlights an important point. I think we've been somewhat critical of Nick McClelland at times because we feel that certain things are being kept secretive when it's not really apparent that they need to be kept secretive. And our issue is never that we just think everything should be public. I think we just like rules being followed and the law being followed. And so if there's a reason to keep things secret, typically what the court calls for is things like hearings to determine that and, you know, people making arguments, here's why it's important to keep this secret versus here's why it's important to put this out there. And that's the system working as it should. We think the secrecy used as a tool to protect people or because it's already part of the law or because it's protecting privacies, that's fine. I just think we'd prefer to see things done in this way where you have people citing actual rules to seal documents rather than what apparently seems to be unilateral decisions to seal things without going through the proper channels, like having a hearing. So we commend Miami County in this case, because obviously it was reasonable to seal it. We'll also link to our previous episode on Kagan Klein's previous hearing, because I do recall that Judge Spahr mentioned and sort of the court officers mentioned at that time that they would expect a pre-sentencing report to be filed with Judge Spahr, you know, so he could make his decision around Kagan's sentence. So this is not like an unexpected development. For those of you who listened to that episode, you may even recall us talking about it. This is not some big bombshell that's going to be dropped right before sentencing that has Kagan, you know, coming clean about everything. This is just par for the course, essentially.
Exactly.
I feel like this is what our show is about a lot of times. It's basically having people suggest interesting possibilities and having us just sadly shoot them down, right?
The cliche when you talk to lawyers and stuff. I remember when I was in law school, lawyers would tell me what's going to happen to you over and over again in your life is people are going to come to you and say, I have a great case. And you have to tell them, no, you don't. And sometimes it feels like we're doing that with the program because people see this thing and they think there's something interesting there. And unfortunately or unfortunately, a lot of time it isn't. This is just routine.
And it's understandable when you're not familiar with the legal system and you're seeing things thrown around like confidential report on the eve of sentencing. You know, that's kind of exciting and it's interesting and you're wondering what's happening. But like most things in life, the reality is often significantly more boring and less explosive than what we kind of come up with in our imaginations or what we think it might be. That being said, I still think this is a very interesting case. Kagan Klein obviously having this link to Delphi, but, you know, certainly has not been charged with anything. And we're happy to cover it and we'll be very interested in what happens at his sentencing on May 18th, I believe.
I believe that's correct. And again, I'm sure we'll say this when we cover his sentencing, but I think the people involved in that case, Judge Spahr, the Miami County Prosecutor's Office, which is, we've indicated, is led by Jeff Sinkovics, and Kagan Klein's defense attorney, Andrew Aki, have all handled that case in an above-the-board way with transparency, and that's the way things are supposed to be handled.
And of course, recently, the state's case has been represented by Assistant Prosecutor Courtney Allwine, whose name I mispronounced in our previous coverage, and I do apologize for that to Miss Allwine and to everybody who knows her. yeah, we'll be interested. One preview I wanted to talk about with the sentencing here. This is something you and I talk a lot about when we're not recording, but my understanding, and correct me if this is an oversimplification, is that judges don't have a lot of leeway in regards to sentencing anymore. Things have changed.
Generally speaking, judges today have less wiggle room than they did in the past. I think one case we've talked about amongst ourselves and actually on the podcast, there was a man named Donald Forrester who committed a rape and he got sentenced to 95 years, which was basically because the judge had a lot of discretion. And he recognized not only was Forrester a rapist, but he was an uncommonly violent and dangerous man. So it is in the interest of society to put him in prison for as long as he's going to be alive.
And that judge made the absolute correct call, in my view, because that's one of the most monstrous people I think we've talked about on the show in terms of what he was doing to people. But for reasons, for political reasons, for various reasons, that's not really the case anymore. You don't get as much discretion. And you can understand that from the perspective of, like, in a case where maybe the defendant just pisses the judge off or he has a bias against the defendant, you wouldn't want them slapping them with 95 years. But at the same time, sometimes you do. And that's unlikely to be the case at this point. And I think people see the judge in the courtroom and they think this person is all powerful. They're calling the shots. They're determining everything. And that is certainly true. The courtroom is their fiefdom, essentially. But when it comes down to handing down sentences, that's not always so cut and dry.
Yeah. I don't know what sentence Kagan Klein is going to get, but I can say that I feel confident that the prosecution is going to make its case in a mature and intelligent way. I feel confident that Kagan Klein's attorney, Mr. Aki, is going to make his case in a mature and reasoned way, and Judge Spahr is going to evaluate it and give a very thoughtful final decision, which we'll find out in a couple of weeks.
Yes, and if the sentence is shorter than you expect, I would say that that's probably not really up to the people in that room. It's guidelines that were not established by those individuals, and, you know, we have to kind of, when I think sometimes when people get outcomes in the justice system that they don't like, they want to blame the people on the ground, but the law is the law, and sentencing guidelines are sentencing guidelines, and if you don't like those, then those would have to be changed, essentially. Because I think a lot of people feel rightfully so that crimes against children and child sexual abuse materials charges are incredibly serious and should be taken seriously. You know, but if the law doesn't reflect that with sentencing guidelines, then that ought to be changed at a legislative level.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember, I'm guessing that most, if not all of the people listening, either now or in the past, have had a job where they were required to follow policies set by other people. And maybe you agree with those policies, maybe you don't. But it's not your responsibility to set those policies, it's your responsibility to follow them.
Maybe you agree with them in most instances, but in a specific case, you don't think they're applicable or you think they should be changed. And yeah, criminal justice system, folks, it's complicated.
A weight loss journey can feel like a lonely struggle, but it doesn't have to be.
For so many of us, lifestyle changes, like deciding to lose weight, adopting a nutritious diet, and taking up fun exercises, are all about putting our own health and wellness first. But it can be really hard to know where to begin or how to keep the weight off once we've seen some progress. Quick fixes like soup diets and juice cleanses are unsustainable. There's a much better way to embark on this journey that over 200,000 people have already chosen. We're talking about the Row Body Program.
Here's how it works. Row gives you access to one of the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Their Row Body Program then sets up a comprehensive weight loss program tailored to your specific lifestyle, health status, and goals. In addition to the weekly shot, you get one-on-one coaching with a registered nurse that can help you adopt and stick with lifestyle changes like exercise routines and nutritious diets. It's a comprehensive program that sees participants lose 15 to 20% of their weight in a year on average. But the real benefit is that you keep that weight off. This is weight loss at its most sustainable.
With Row, the average weight loss is 15 to 20% of your weight in 1 year, in conjunction with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to row.co/msheet. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. Go to row.co/msheet. That's ro.co/msheet.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Now let's talk about the Richard Allen case. As we know, a while back, Richard Allen's defense attorneys filed an emergency motion in which they made some shocking allegations about the conditions in which Richard Allen was being kept at Westville Correctional Facility. The state ultimately responded to those allegations, but chose to keep its response secret. And I think that is an unfortunate decision. If someone says, I think that's an unfortunate decision.
Oh, yeah. When you get a case that's going to trial and is in the legal system, you expect a lot more transparency and light to be shined on the situation than we're getting. I think it's very unfortunate because here you have basically the defense leveling serious accusations at law enforcement, at prison officials.
These allegations leveled by the defense, they could be 100% true. They could be part true, part exaggeration. They could be entirely exaggerated.
Or they could be something that maybe is true from one perspective, but there's a good reason for that.
But I think we, as residents of the state of Indiana, have the right to know how the government is doing things in our name. And the fact that whatever response Nick McClelland made to these is being kept from us is frankly somewhat infuriating, because it gives us no basis to judge the accuracy or inaccuracy of the defense claims. And usually, if someone says something terrible about a person and the person doesn't respond, there's a tendency to maybe believe the worst about the person.
And I think it's really especially distressing because you have a situation where, through no fault of their own, law enforcement in this case, I'm speaking specifically about Carroll County Sheriff's Office in this case, because they were the ones directly accused in the defense's filing of basically saying, we can't move Allen, we're not going to move him. You know, but I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, they not only are not getting defended by Nick McClelland in a filing, in a public filing where he's pushing back or saying, well, you know, that's not really how it went down. They're not even able to respond in the press. And I'll note that in past instances, I mean, I remember when the defense first came out with their statement on Richard Allen, Tobe Lesenby, the then sheriff of Carroll County, immediately was in the press saying, no, this is, you know, this aspect is ridiculous, giving comment. And that all went away when the gag order came down, the gag order that was, of course, requested by Nick McClelland. And so he's depriving his colleagues in the county of their ability to defend themselves from accusations about serious problems here. And again, we're certainly not weighing in on like, oh, this is definitely all true or it's definitely all not true. But it's just more of like there should be an ability to have a push and pull here and have one side saying their piece and another side saying theirs, and then leaving it to the public to sort through it and come up with what side do they feel is behaving more credibly. This is a lopsided argument because the defense is able to communicate what they need to communicate through these filings. And, you know, I mean, and the prosecution's just not allowing that for the state side. And I think that is bizarre, troubling. I think the people of Indiana deserve some answers on this. And I guess what bothers me too is that the secrecy, as always, is going down in a way that is not appropriate. This is not how you do things by just unilaterally deciding to seal everything. You know, there should be these processes in place. There should be hearings. And frankly, I think in the beginning of this case, when Prosecutor McClelland essentially attempted to seal the PCA, claiming that it would hurt the case if it was released, And then when the PCA came out, I think everybody had the reaction of like, how? You know, like, how would this hurt the case being out there? Judge Gull immediately pretty much made it public. I mean, but by noting
he really damaged his credibility.
Yeah, that was, I believe, an overstatement, or at least I'm not seeing how it could. I don't understand how it could not be an overstatement, because I mean, there may be things that we're not aware of that, you know, would factor in into his decision making. And in that case, fine. But in general, like, when somebody does that, I don't know how believable I find it when they're basically saying all of these other things must remain sealed. I think that it's very important for the prosecution to be conducting itself in a way that is transparent and open, because there is a organized, small, but organized minority of people who follow this case who are liable to get into full-fledged conspiracy theory mode. That's not good for Carroll County. That's not good for its citizens. That's not good for its public servants. And you are giving people who want to assume the worst about this case free ammunition to hurl back at you when you basically do this.
And again, I want to stress the allegations that the defense made were incredibly serious. And as a resident of the state of Indiana, I deserve to know what the state is doing in my name. Are they really abusing a man who is legally innocent in the fashion that the defense alleged? Or is the defense exaggerating in an attempt to score some sort of points? I want to know the answer to that. I want to know where the truth lies. And Nick McClelland is not allowing us to know that. He is not posting his response publicly.
Personally, I mean, I'm going to give you my personal opinion on what's happening there. And this may be wrong, so keep that in mind. But I kind of tend to think that it's probably somewhere in the middle. You probably have Alan enduring some pretty intense prison conditions. Westville is a notorious prison. He's in isolation. He's under suicide watch. He's not doing well. I believe that. I don't know that it was definitely some sort of machinations by local authorities to try to punish him. I think it's possible that it was determined sort of like, well, he'll be very safe in isolation. Not really thinking about his mental well-being, but just like, no one's going to shiv him there. And then because he was not being represented at the time this decision was made, it kind of just proceeded from there. And so I think that's problematic, but I don't think that necessarily points to maliciousness on anyone's part. But I mean, how hard is it to just say that? How hard is it to say, well, here's our side? Because as you said, as citizens of Indiana, people should be entitled to know this. And it should not be, if your case is so such that you have, you know, everything has to be kept in the shadows, then what is going on? And I don't really know that it does not engender confidence, and it should stop, because it's not right. This is not how things are done. This is not how a case should be professionally tried in secrecy. We're not to get all ridiculous, but we're in a democracy, folks. Like, we're like, it's, we shouldn't be having like secret trials or trials that are completely in shadow. There are instances where secrecy in cases is very important. You have witnesses who are at risk. You have, you know, flight risk with suspects. So fine, but then put it in a filing, put it in a hearing, put your point out there. You don't just unilaterally just start sealing stuff at random.
So on April 14th, Judge Gull entered her response to all of this, and I will read it. On November 3rd, 2022, the judge of the Carroll Circuit Court, at the request of the Carroll County Sheriff, entered the following order, quote, accordingly, pursuant to Indiana Code 3533.11.1, the court orders the Sheriff of Carroll County to transfer a defendant to a facility of the Department of Correction designated by the Commissioner of the Department as suitable for the confinement of defendant and provided the space is available, end quote. These types of orders are referred to as, quote, safekeeper orders. The Department of Correction has complied with this order, Consistent with that order and the safekeeper statute, the Department of Correction is authorized to move the defendant within the Department of Correction to accommodate his medical and physical needs pursuant to medical directives by the Department of Correction physicians, psychiatrist, or psychologist. So that's a bit of a word salad. I think one thing that is worth stressing there is, you may recall in the original emergency motion filed by Brad Rosie, he requested that Allen be moved to Cass County Jail. And basically, the judge there is saying no, that he can only be moved within the Department of Correction, and county jails do not fall under the purview of the Department of Correction.
Right. Having spoken to some former inmates of Westville on the show, I mean, I think I can see where there would be concern about a county jail being suitable for Richard Allen. One thing that we've consistently heard is that other inmates, whether they're in jail, whether they're in prison, do not take kindly to people who are even just accused in this case of hurting children. And so that alone is problematic for Allen. He's not been convicted, so it's very weird for him to be in a prison. But I could understand where there is security concerns.
It's worth noting that in the original motion, Attorney Rosie indicated that Cass County personnel indicated they felt confident they could indeed keep Richard Allen safe at Cass County Jail.
Yep. I think, yeah, I wish at this point we just had more clarity from the prosecutor, because then I feel like we could better assess what the judge's decision ended up being.
Last week, there was a bit more activity in the file. There was a notation on April 28th. Correspondence to/from court filed and is described as a Westville correctional inmate letter. And there was immediate speculation that this letter might be from Richard Allen. Anything is possible in this case, but it's worth noting that when Richard Allen did indeed file a letter with the court, it was described differently in the record. That was back on November 9th, 2022. It was correspondence to/from court filed, correspondence received from defendant requesting appointment of public defender, filed by Allen Richard M. So basically, back then, they were clearly identifying the letter came from Richard Allen, and then even going so far to say it was filed by him.
And let's look at the recent letter that was filed on April 28th, 2023. It's listed as correspondence to from court filed. And then it just says Westville correctional inmate letter.
It doesn't indicate who it was filed by. And if it was filed by one of the parties in the case, be it the state of Indiana or the defense, we would expect to see that indicated.
Yeah, precisely. Given how a lot of people in prison feel about, like, snitches and people who are snitching or ratting somebody out or just being in contact with the court or law enforcement in a way that's deemed improper in prison culture, that would be actually something that would probably make sense to keep sealed and keep somebody anonymous. So that's an instance where I want to point out that we're not just against stealing. We're against random and seemingly improper sealing procedures. If you want to keep some information private because it'll, like, help someone not get killed, great. Also, Richard Allen is being represented by Andy Baldwin and Brad Rosie. So he has advocates. He has lawyers representing him. So my understanding, and correct me if this is wrong, Kevin, but would he even be allowed to kind of just unilaterally reach out to the court?
It wouldn't be a good idea. And also, I know based on what Attorney Rosie wrote about Richard Allen in that motion, it's not even clear if Richard Allen is capable of writing a letter at this point.
Right. That would be a pretty good indicator that he was faking it if then he's composing, like, a well-crafted letter when he's supposedly suffering from mental issues as a result of his incarceration. So, you know, that would be a kind of bad move by him. It seems to me that it's probably not from Allen as a result of that.
Anything's possible. I think it's probably not from Allen.
Yeah, so then it kind of raises the question, well, why is a Westville inmate reaching out to the court?
I don't think we have anything we can report on that.
No. But it's interesting.
It is interesting. I'm sorry to be so mysterious.
I just think it's really important for people to really look at the language. And if you're making an assumption about something like this, and there's a comparison point that you can kind of look at previous data and make a comparison or make a link, really look at what language is used. Because I don't think we should be assuming a lot at this point. And I don't think we should be assuming that this is from Alan. Again, it might turn out to be, maybe we're totally wrong and they just decided to file it in a really weird way. But, you know, if things are different, they probably are different for a reason. I mean, even today, weren't people posting about, didn't you get a, do you want to talk about your heart attack story?
Okay.
Yeah, didn't some kind of misunderstanding over a filing almost give you a heart attack today, Kevin?
Yeah, I saw somebody was posting somewhere a screenshot that seemed to be from Richard Allen's My Case page indicating that there was a change of plea hearing scheduled. And if that was true, it would indicate that Richard Allen would be pleading guilty. But that turned out to be a different Richard Allen in another case.
Yeah. So just really, we should all be really, really cautious in checking our work, or we'll give Kevin a heart attack. So no one wants that. Previously, when we spoke about the case with the Hoosier public defender, there had just been a number of subpoenas filed. And we can talk a little bit more about some of those now.
So a couple of subpoenas in the Richard Allen case were released today. The first one is to CVS headquarters. CVS is, of course, the chain of drugstores and pharmacies. It's all over the country. There's probably one near you. Richard Allen used to work there. Doesn't say exactly what information or records McClelland wants from them. We can guess. We can speculate. Perhaps employment records, time records. You know, was Richard Allen working at the time of the crime? I'd be interested if I was McClelland, maybe in any sort of employment HR issues.
Yeah, personnel issues. We've spoken on the show with two of his former colleagues, and neither of them really had severe red flags. One got along with him well. The other felt he was a bit of a micromanager and there was definitely a personality conflict, but did not feel that he was a creep or anything like that. But one thing to look at would be any sexual improprieties at the workplace, any, you know, investigations into his conduct. Again, we've not heard about anything like that, but, you know, that's something they'd be looking into. I imagine things like time off and, yeah, was he working that day? Was he supposed to work that day? Was he working the next day? I mean, like, when? I mean, did he take any time off in the wake of the murders? And basically, when we talked to the CVS employees that had worked with him, they indicated that they strongly felt or had no reason not to feel that CVS would, you know, they felt that CVS would likely comply and work with law enforcement and the police, you know, on this. With such a huge retail organization, you know, they also have, you know, like asset protection and security apparatus. So I imagine that they are well used to dealing with law enforcement and cooperating in these instances.
The second subpoena that was made public today was to the Westville Correctional Facility. I say these subpoenas were made public. Basically, we don't know what they're asking for. We just know who they're asking. And so I don't know. We don't know exactly what they are asking for from the Westville Correctional Facility. Do you want to make any educated guesses?
From the Westville Correctional Facility? I think you just have to think about what would they have. So, I mean, footage?
off the top of my head, I would assume that in a maximum security facility, there would likely be surveillance of some of these people.
Telephone records. Telephone recordings.
Generally speaking, when you're in prison, there's no expectation of privacy. So I would imagine any conversations he might have either via video chat or text messages or chirps, as they're
called. If he's writing letters to people, images.
So these are things that potentially would fall within the purview of that, I would imagine.
This just popped into my mind. And if we have any medical personnel, and we might get an opportunity to speak with some folks, but I'm curious about if he had an initial mental health check-in when he was first processed into Westville, would that be private? Or would that be something that the prosecution could get their hands on?
I think the prosecution would be very interested in that because, of course, in that emergency motion, attorney Brad Rosie made some very specific claims about Richard Allen having specific mental health concerns. I imagine the prosecutor might be interested in getting records to determine whether or not those concerns are valid.
Whether they're valid, and also could they be brought on not by just some underlying condition, but actually the stress of feeling guilty about a crime.
Or the stress of being an innocent man being physically and emotionally abused in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine they definitely want to have a better understanding of his psychological and emotional landscape. I just don't know if that, I mean, I don't know, like, do your HIPAA rights kind of go out the window when you're in prison? I have no idea. So maybe we'll find that out at some point soon. So that concludes our understanding of some of the latest developments in the cases around Kegan Klein and Richard Allen. We discussed through some of those recent filings what we believe they mean and talked through some of the issues underpinning all this. I think I'd like to end on another note on some of the secrecy regarding the Richard Allen case. I think it's important for us to remember that making accusations around whole-scale corruption and cover-ups is talk like that's very cheap on the internet. When it comes to people who are spouting that, people want you to believe that they're an expert and only they can kind of break the case wide open and solve everything. But we really haven't seen any evidence of that. So when we're criticizing people, specifically in this case, Nick McClelland, about the gag order, keeping things secret, it's not from a place where we think we're, you know, blowing the lid on something. I think what we're seeing here is an overly cautious approach from the prosecution to this case. And emotionally, even intellectually, I can understand that. Keeping things secret keeps them safe. It means it's not going to tip off anybody or you know, maybe mess up one of your strategies. I get that. I think we both get that. But that is simply not how things should be done, in our opinion. And I think the law on this backs us up. There's a reason why things are done out in the open with criminal cases in this country. And it's because the public has a vested interest in the judicial system, in the criminal justice system. We have a right to be watching what is being done on our behalf. And we just think it's important for the public officials in this case to really remember that and recognize that it means something beyond just this case and that things should be done out in the open. And hopefully they can adjust their strategies based on this, because I really don't think it's helping their case. And if anything, I think it's making more and more people susceptible to narratives that are nonsense, but sound good when you're faced with so much secrecy. So hopefully that's a nuanced take on this whole thing, but
well said.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, That's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for the Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.